Wayne Carnell.
Thanks, Marty. Actually, I just want to share an observation, actually in response to John's observations. While I fully agree that there probably can be action taken, perhaps from our perspective, perhaps from an inspection process, et cetera, I do also believe, though, that there could be improvements made to the accounting, or the auditing standards that would help prevent the problem from appearing and taking place. The problem with just relying on the inspection process and enforcement process is you'll still have the problem. It will just move from one auditor to another auditor. Again, there's a large volume of these companies. There's literally hundreds. I would rather have preventive medicine and be able to address it so the problem cannot exist in the future rather than just go from one auditor to another auditor.
Wayne, I missed part of that. Were you saying improvements in the accounting standards or auditing standards or both?
I meant the auditing standards, Marty. In other words, basically the issues we were talking about yesterday in terms of identifying who is the principal auditor. Can a person in the U.S., when most of the work is subcontracted out to a Chinese individual, a Chinese firm, can they, under the existing auditing standards, sign as a principal auditor, and should they be able to do so in the future? That's why, again, I agree that there can be issues regarding the inspection process that can help address the issue. But if you find some firm that has deficiencies and you say that, you know, that you attack that firm, the work will just move to another firm in the U.S. I think it would be better to try to modify the auditing standards so this type of a problem and situation cannot exist, rather than just looking at it through an inspection process. I'm not convinced the inspection process or an enforcement process will address and cure the problem.
Good. Thank you for that input. I agree. It's an important issue, and as I've said, it's one of our highest priorities. Doug Carmichael.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on the comments on the bank failures and the loan loss allowance impairments and so on. In contrast to the last go-round that we had of these matters, where it could be contended that the market collapsed so quickly that no one could have anticipated it, and the losses are just the result of economic matters. The additional factor this time is the for public institutions is the reporting on internal control, the opinions given on internal control. So whereas in the past it might have been contended that, and that people did contend that, say, Staff Accounting Bulletin 102, with its requirements on documentation and process and documentation that linked the allowance with the process, that wasn't part of GAAP and therefore not something that the auditor needed to pay attention to as far as giving an opinion on the financial statements. With the additional factor of giving opinions on internal control, I don't think that contention is any longer possible. And in enforcement actions and inspections, I hope attention will be paid to the way that additional variable should have affected things and will in the future affect things.
Good. Thank you very much. Barbara Roper?
Yeah, just back to this issue. Of the enforcement versus standards approach. If there is a clear communication from the PCAOB and or the SEC that this practice violates the existing standard, and if there are enforcement actions that impose tough sanctions, then I have to believe that that has some kind of deterrent effect. Or if it doesn't, the whole basis on which we do securities regulation isn't terribly effective. And it doesn't mean that we don't do a new standard under two circumstances. One, if the current standard is not effectively enforceable, that would be a great concern, and we need to fix what it is about the current standard, which seems to embody some pretty sound principles that would make it difficult or impossible to enforce. But assuming that that's not the case, because it's been suggested that that's not the case, then there may also be an appropriate place for a new standard if there are things that we could do to improve the existing standard. But if we improve an standard and we don't enforce it, then we haven't accomplished anything. And that we really need, I mean, if you have a standard where there's widespread, clear violation of that standard and we don't enforce it, you've just rewritten the standard without changing a word. And so I think, you know, regardless of what we do going forward with new standards, there has to be a prompt and forceful response in the inspection and enforcement areas.
Barbara, thanks for those comments. Of course, under I think I did say yesterday that we felt we did have tools and we were not encumbered by existing standards to bring enforcement actions in appropriate situations. And of course, the regulations and law requires that enforcement actions we bring stay non-public. So whether we bring an action or not, unfortunately, the public doesn't know about that. So I can only point that out as well until the matters are resolved. But having said that, I hear your comments. Thank you. Lynn Turner.
Marty and Wayne, I'd just like to echo what both John and Barbara have said. With the Chinese companies, I don't think this is so much an issue of standards as it is of people just ignoring a standard. I don't understand how you can read even the existing principal standard and go through it and apply it and come to the conclusion what some of these companies are doing is okay. And I remember us writing a report on this issue back in 2006 at Glasus, so this is not necessarily a new issue. Whereby you had a similar situation with the company. So it's been around for some period of time now, and it sounds from what Wayne is saying is not only has it been around, the abuses have been allowed to perpetrate themselves and grow totally unchecked. So in a way, the CPA firms that are really following the standards and not doing that type of work are put at a disadvantage to those who seem to skirt around the standard. And I think more than anything, Wayne, you know, the SEC is supposed to be, first and foremost, a law enforcement agency. And I think you have a chance here to go do that. And if every time we have people abusing standards, we turn it into a need for a new standard, we don't have principle-based standards. And that standard today is a principle-based standard. And what I hear you saying is, no, let's go to more detailed rules. But you got to decide one way or the other. Are you going to have principles and enforce them? Or are you going to have a 1,000-page-long rule? And I'd much prefer the principle-based thing with some enforcement. But without enforcement, then you got no rule, just as Barb said. And the inspection process really isn't put to use. So I'd encourage, you know, you take a few of these guys out behind the woodshed and send a clear message, and that'll do us a lot more good than a 1,000-page rule. And I don't think the others will go where the first ones went if they know what's going to happen to them.
We'll take that woodshed comment under consideration.
Wayne, I was trying to figure out whether you could get this over to the Corp Fin process where you're, as you know, doing 5,000 reviews a year, so it isn't this kind of one-off enforcement process. I mean, if you added if you looked at, for example, any company that had, when you were doing the review process where more than, I'm just going to pick a number, 90% of your assets were, or revenues were, in a jurisdiction other than where your principal auditor was located, you then added a bunch of questions that basically flushed out the kind of issue we're talking about here so that you had a batch of information so you could simply reject the audit report in the 10-K or the 20-F. I mean, just some... you know, get some triggers so you then hit the company with a bunch of questions and then just said it's not a good 10K or it's not a good 20F. But if you get it over to the CorpFin review process, then you've got, you reach a lot more companies. But I don't know. That's just thinking out loud almost.
John, I guess a couple things. One is, perhaps that's an observation that Lynn has made. I mean, is this a new issue? I wouldn't say it's a new issue. What has evolved is that there's a lot more of these companies. The significance of them has grown. You can less look at the list of foreign private issuers, and many of these companies in question are actually domestic issuers. But if you look at the number of foreign private issuers, I think the second largest country now is the Cayman Islands, and it's not hotels that people are registering with. It's basically those are Chinese companies, as well as a number of the Canadian companies, and again, large portion of U.S. companies. So what's changed is the volume of the companies. The challenge, John, we have asked questions. It is, as you know, in terms of our review process, it is relatively limited. We don't ask. Our interaction is not through the auditor. It's through the company. And we can ask questions through the company and have the auditor provide us with certain information. But we are very limited in pursuing it. It's not an effective way because it really gets involved with the work papers. You could have a situation where it could be perfectly acceptable to have an auditor from a different country auditing the information in a different country and have direct supervision. He could have his staff over there. It's really getting into the specifics we are challenging, and it is very difficult to extract that information that is necessary through a CorpFin review process where our interactions are with the company. We don't get auditor work papers. We don't ask auditors, what level of work did you do? That just has not historically been our mandate. I do think, and again, it is a matter of actually looking at what was done, what the work papers were done by the auditor. If the auditor actually is, by some chance, it'd be very difficult for us to be a judge, if you would, in that situation, to ask, do you have Chinese people on the staff, and be able to prove that out with the auditor, because, again, our communication is through the company, not through the auditor. That's just not our mandate.
Well, I appreciate all the input on this subject. It's been very valuable dialogue, both with respect to the financial institutions, the situations, impairments, the situations where principal auditors' questions clearly come into play as well, and these are important matters, and these discussions are very valuable as we think about our steps going forward. One other emerging issue, and I know we're a little bit behind schedule, but before we take our break, I'd like to just finish this item, if you bear with me, was raised by a SAG member, concern about articles that have appeared in a number of places and trends which show that audit fees are being reduced, and in many cases significantly. The concern is expressed that the fees reductions appear so large that in certain instances it could have the impact of impairing audit quality if firms decrease their hours in these periods where audit risk actually could be very high given the current economic environment. So interested in response to that, you might first of all say, well, what's the board's response? I'd say that the board and inspections division is very aware of these developments. Inspections and my conversations with them are proactively considering and looking at fee reductions as they consider audit risks and which audits to inspect. And in their conversations with the leadership of the firm leadership as well. So without going into any further detail, just say that, yes, our inspections division is well aware of this and takes these matters into consideration in planning their inspections in the upcoming season. But having said that, I'm interested in any responses otherwise about concerns about potential impairment of audit quality that might be brought on by these significant reductions in audit fees. Galen Hanson.
Actually, this is a topic that at NASBA we've been working. We've got a project going on right now, and I think it's not just audit quality. It's auditor independence. There's actually a couple of the states that have in their state laws a prohibition of conducting an audit at a loss. Texas and North Carolina are two of them, and. You know, I think that this is a concern because are we taking on an audit with the idea that we can sell other services? Are we taking on an audit up front? Not because, and it's difficult to quantify what a loss is. I mean, everybody knows that there's valid business reasons for doing off-season work. You're wanting to get into a new industry and everything else. And that's fine and good. But when you know up front that you're going to cut the audit fee 50% of what you can practically do it, I've got to believe that that's going to have an impact on audit quality. And so I think this is something that hopefully the inspectors are looking at. Does it pass the smell test? Is there any reasonable and conceivable way that you think that this audit could get done in the amount of time that's being budgeted? And if it can't, then there's something else going on.
Thanks, Kellen. Those are good comments. I see a number of cards up. I'm also interested in some of people who think, I'll talk from an investor's point of view. I believe I've heard at prior SAG meetings some investor point of view saying that they were wondering who was pushing for the fee reduction because as investors, they wanted substantial audits done and they were not looking for reductions in fees. So any comments from those folks would be helpful in this discussion. Lynn Turner.
Certainly, Marty, I'd echo those comments you just made from the perspective to boards of the two institutional funds I sit on. I haven't ever heard anyone say, let's go cut the cost when it could be cutting into audit quality. The recent CFO.com article that's gotten so much attention is extremely concerning. They cite one case in which I think it's IDT where the audit fee went from $4 million some change down to $1 million and some change. And there's just no way possible but what audit quality hasn't been impacted by such a huge, that's not a 50%. That is a huge drop in fees that the data in the article is in fact correct. But also equally concerning about that article as you read through it is the number of CFOs that they talk about in there and the comments from the CFO. And it leads you with a very clear belief that in their particular situations, it is not the audit committee that's hiring and firing and doing the negotiating with the auditor at all. It's all being done by the CFO. Notwithstanding the legal requirement in Sarbanes-Oxley that's the role and the responsibility and the authority of an audit committee. So I think it is great to know that the PCAOB is inspecting audit quality. I think it's a high-risk area for you, so I'd encourage you to focus on those audits this year where we see a significant reduction in fee to see if audit quality is being impended. But also in those situations, ask you to take a look at just exactly who is doing this negotiating, who is doing this hiring and firing of the auditor, and inquire of the audit committee, why is it that they were trying to get such significant reductions in cost, and were they doing it on behalf of their investors, or were they doing it on behalf of their management team? Because we clearly know who elects the auditor and who their audit committee and who they're responsible for. I'm very concerned that 4 to 5 years down the road, we're going to run into a period of time where audit quality had eroded. We're right back into a lot of litigation, and then the firms are saying, why me? And quite frankly, the answer to that will be in the mirror for them.
Thanks, Lynn. Damon Silver.
Yeah, I think that similar to what Lynn said, and I think we've investor representatives around this table have expressed this before, that shaving the audit fee at the expense of audit quality is not in our interest, although cost control is in our interest, but that particular form of cost control is a penny-wise and pound-foolish sort of thing. That being said, you know, it's sort of a tricky business, right? You don't want to be in the position of saying to boards and audit committees, you have to, you know, if you don't pay X, we're coming after you. Seems a little an odd position to take. I wonder whether there is some ability, on the board's part to try to look at metrics of what constitutes reasonable negotiation on the part of an issuer, of a preparer, and the audit committee, and what constitutes an agreement not to do the job. It strikes me that audit firms might have some incentive here to try to help the board define where that line is. But I think in doing so, the board ought to take that with maybe one or two grains of salt.
Thanks, Damon. Wayne Collins?
Yeah, to the extent there is an issue, and it has been brought up that the audit committee certainly should be somewhere in this analysis, because they are the ones that are charged with the responsibility of engaging the auditors. And if they're allowing this to happen, to the extent that it could impair audit quality, then are they exercising their appropriate oversight? And is that indicative of a tone at the top issue with respect to the control environment? So, and the audit committee is outside of the purview of the standard setting here, but there are perhaps other bodies that could look at that particular issue, because the, you know, that part of the three-legged stool, if it's not working, causes the imbalance to perpetuate.
Thanks, Wayne. There are the three cards up. We're a bit behind schedule in terms of our break and our agenda today, but these are very important topics. So why don't we take the three cards up, and then we'll move to a break. Denny Beresford.
Well, speaking on behalf of audit committees, we take our job very seriously. At least I take my job very seriously. I'm sure that there are exceptions to the rule. In the case of my three boards, we have had essentially level audit fees for the last 3 years. That's been a combination of the company taking a very hard look at the allocation of responsibility between the outside auditors and internal auditors, having a little bit more work being done by the internal auditors, being carefully overseen by the audit committee. Frankly, the outside auditors being taking a little bit of a cut in their rate per hour, not cutting the number of hours, but recognizing that times are tough for a lot of people, and that they're not going to necessarily be making quite as much money this year, similar to the corporations that they're auditing. I think that it's very appropriate for the PCAOB and everyone else to be taking a hard look at this, but I think because we see some isolated situations where individual corporations are taking what appears to be irresponsible actions, and I agree with the situation where going from $4 million to $1 million looks pretty outrageous on the surface. I don't know what the situation was, but at least it raises some questions. Doesn't mean that all corporations are going this way. My understanding is that audit fees in general for larger companies have stayed relatively flat. They haven't been going down substantially, and I think it's largely because of what I've said, a cut or staying about the same in rates per hour and taking a very hard look at the allocation of the hours.
Thanks, Danny. Barbara Roper?
Yeah, just quickly, I don't want to suggest that there's any kind of comprehensive data on this, but there was a survey a couple of years ago that AARP conducted among its members in the context of the SOX 404 costs. The suggestion was continually being made that investors objected to the costs of SOX 404 compliance, and in fact, the survey that AARP conducted suggested that they they, in fact, embraced the idea that we would spend more in order to provide a higher level of assurance. So I think there's at least, you know, some modest data to suggest that investors are not the source of the pressure to reduce costs at the expense of accuracy.
Thank you. And Peggy Ferran.
I'm the only thing keeping you up from your break, so I'll keep it very short. But I think most people have said it. I would not focus so much on cost, although I would use that if it goes significantly down. I'd focus on quality. And I think everyone has said that. You know, look, everyone is taking hits. People and audit committees are trying to be very, very efficient. They are negotiating. They certainly are not saying audit less, but I think they're trying to say audit smarter. And you're seeing that in the legal profession. You're seeing that in every profession. So going down 300%, I agree with you, Lynn, something's wrong. But keeping something flat, I think that's what everyone's trying to focus on, efficiency these days. Not quality. Quality, you can't reduce your quality.
Well, thank you, everybody, for your input on these important matters as part of the emerging issues discussion, as well as your input on our standard-setting agenda, which I hope you view as ambitious as we view, and a lot of work in front of us. So with that, we'll take a break till, let's try till about 11:05, 20 minutes, and we'll see you back here then. All right. The next item on our agenda is an update by our acting chairman, Dan Gelzer, on the Treasury Advisory Committee's recommendations on the auditing profession. With that, Dan?
Thanks very much, Marty. While the meeting is almost over, let me begin by welcoming everybody to the April 2010 Standing Advisory Group meeting. I'm sorry that I missed the session yesterday and the dinner yesterday, and I haven't had a chance to speak to many of you, but as always, we do appreciate you taking the time from your schedules to participate in these meetings. I think we had two particularly important topics yesterday, principal auditor responsibilities and the auditor's reporting model, and I know that the discussion of those topics will be important to our work going forward. At the October 2009 meeting of this group, the last meeting of this group, members expressed an interest in what we were doing with respect to the recommendations of the Treasury's Advisory Committee on the auditing profession. So we thought that this meeting would be a good opportunity to give a bit of an update on that subject. You should find in front of you a written status report that's been prepared and distributed. I would invite you all to take a look at that. There are, depending upon how you count, there are approximately 15 recommendations of the advisory committee that relate to the PCAOB, and those are covered in that document. It's also going to be available, or I guess is available now, on our website for those who are listening in or otherwise don't have access to the hard copy here at the meeting this morning that would like to take a look at it. The paper is organized around the three subcommittees of the advisory committee: human capital, which dealt with recommendations focusing on improving accounting education and otherwise strengthening the human capital that's attracted to the auditing profession; second, the firm structure and finances subcommittee, which focused on recommendations relating to firm governance, transparency, communications, and audit quality; and then third, the concentration and competition subcommittee, which made recommendations about ways to increase audit market competition and auditor choice. I'm going to walk through quickly, I hope, where we stand on the various recommendations that relate to the PCAOB. I'm going to try and do that primarily from a factual standpoint. To the extent I wander off into expressing views or opinions on these recommendations, they'll simply be my own. I won't be speaking for the board. The other board members are here, and I'm knowing them as I do, I'm sure if anybody disagrees with anything that I have to say, they'll feel free to add their own views. As I described, the paper is organized around the three subcommittees of the advisory committee. I'm going to organize my comments somewhat differently because, to me, they reflect better how we've approached these recommendations. I'm going to divide the recommendations into three groups. Those that are part of or at least natural extensions of existing PCAOB programs and initiatives. Second, those that while not things we were in effect already doing or already in some fashion involved with are natural extensions of our mission and work we were already engaged in. And then third, some of the recommendations that are somewhat broader and to my mind at least raise broader and more difficult questions about the board's relationship with the auditing profession. So first, the ones that are natural extensions of existing PCAOB initiatives. I've put seven in this category. First, there were recommendations relating to small firms and including small firm representatives and PCAOB advisory groups and other consultative activities and other steps to reduce barriers to the growth of small firms. I think this is something that we have been fairly active in already. As many of you know, we run a series of forums on auditing in the small business environment. We've been doing that. I believe this is the seventh year now that we've had the forums. They're aimed specifically at the smaller firms and giving them an opportunity to interact with the PCAOB's staff and kind of get a firsthand understanding of our work and how our work affects them. We'll start up, I guess, later this month, the first of the 2010 small business audit firm forums. I think they've been quite successful. As to including representatives of smaller firms in our advisory bodies and other kinds of public outreach that we have, I think we've always tried to include on the SAG at least some representation from firms other than those that are annually inspected. When we've had panel presentations to the SAG on auditing topics, at least where it fits, we've always tried to include a representative of one of the triennially inspected firms. I know particularly, or one example that comes to mind is we did that with our discussion some time ago of EQR, Engagement Quality Review, and we've done it with other topics. We'll certainly continue to do so in the future. As to input into our standard setting, I see that a little different in that while there's some dispute, I guess, in some quarters about exactly how we ought to go about setting and auditing standards, we've done it largely through a public notice and comment transparent process in which anybody can comment. We certainly invite and do receive comments from smaller firms. In those cases where we've had interpretive work or standard setting that specifically affects smaller firms, we have reached out to representatives of the smaller firms for input. I think one example in that regard is the guidance that we published a year or so about internal control auditing in the smaller public company context. We did get input from smaller firms in that regard. Another recommendation of a little different sort under this heading is that we should inquire about the transition process between predecessor and successor auditors. I think the thought here was particularly to the extent that there might be transition from larger firms to smaller firms, or at least that there might be barriers to competition in the way that the outgoing auditor interrelates to the incoming auditor. This has been added as one of the topics that our inspection group does make inquiries about in appropriate cases. We've never had a Part 1 finding in an inspection report on this subject. I think it is an area where, to the extent that we find problems or issues, we would look at standard setting, and maybe beyond that would publish the information in one of our what we call 4010 reports, where we're able to talk about what we find in inspections without identifying the specific firms and clients involved. The second recommendation that I put under this heading, that is related to things we were already doing, is a recommendation to enhance regulatory cooperation between the PCAOB and its foreign counterparts. I think that is one that was specifically aimed at, in effect, validating work that we were already doing. And I think this one is very much a good news and a bad news story. Certainly, working with other regulators, conducting joint inspections where it's possible outside the United States is something that's always been one of our goals. It's kind of baked into our rules with respect to foreign inspections, and I think it's been successful. We've conducted somewhere upwards of 200 inspections of non-U.S. firms in, 33 jurisdictions so far, and working with our foreign counterparts in those countries where there is an inspection program for local auditors is a very important part of it. On the other hand, I guess picking up on some of the discussion that's taken place here already, I think it wouldn't be candid if I didn't say we have extremely serious problems in our terms of our foreign inspection responsibilities today. I personally might regard it as perhaps the most serious problem that we have in terms of accomplishing what I view as our statutory mission. We're unable to conduct any inspections in any of the EU jurisdictions today. We're unable to conduct any inspections in mainland China. We are able to conduct some in Hong Kong. We're unable to conduct inspections in Switzerland. These things put, I think, a very large hole in our ability to look at audit work that's being performed and on which U.S. investors are relying. In all cases, it's not because of any reluctance or unwillingness on our part. It's because the other jurisdiction involved, for a variety of reasons, doesn't want to let PCOB inspection staff in. We're certainly working on these problems. Some of them, at least, may be solved if and when Congress passes the financial services regulation, financial services legislation currently pending, which includes a provision that would let us share inspection information with non-U.S. regulators. We're currently not able to do that, and it's at least asserted to be one of the obstacles to our conducting these foreign inspections. But this is a problem. It's certainly one we're working on, certainly one that we're in discussions with the SEC about, but we have a long way to go. A couple of other things quickly on foreign cooperation. We are a founding member and a very active member of IFIAR, the International Forum of Independent Audit Regulators, which brings together all of the independent of the profession audit regulators around the world. We meet in plenary sessions twice a year. There was one earlier in March of this year in Abu Dhabi. We've really tried to emphasize in terms of IFIAR's work the importance of sharing knowledge between audit regulators and particularly sharing knowledge about conducting inspections. Along those lines, we're going to host IFIAR's inspection workshop here in Washington next winter, and we feel that IFIAR is an important vehicle for that kind of knowledge sharing. We also hold our own inspection workshops each year here in Washington, not limited to IFIAR members, but to any foreign audit oversight body that's interested in attending. I think we generally have upwards of 40 countries that participate. We do this free of charge for them and with a view to spreading knowledge about the inspection process and how inspections can be conducted effectively. The third recommendation I would put in this category is one that we create a faculty fellowship program. This is part of a larger recommendation about improving academic training in auditing and the availability of professorships and other academic resources for auditing. We announced at the end of last year, December 22, 2009, that we were creating a faculty fellowship program. We solicited applications for that, which we received in January, and we're now going through those applications with a view to selecting the first PCOB academic fellow. That person will be on board for the 2010-2011, academic season. Fourth, there was a recommendation that the SEC and the PCAOB compile their independence standards into one document or one source to make it easier for people who have to comply with them to understand the various independence requirements. The SEC has taken the lead on that project. We have contributed in terms of our independence requirements. And I guess I would have to say, while I know a lot of work has been done on it, I'm not sure where it stands in terms of completion, but it certainly is something that's and progress at the SEC. There was a proposal or recommendation in this area that the SEC amend the 8K requirements so that the PCAOB would be notified of engagement partner changes, or I think what the report called premature engagement partner changes. I'm not aware of the SEC taking any action on that, but from the standpoint of our inspection process, we do this would be one of the things that we try to gather information on from the firms as part of identifying what particular engagements that we want to direct our inspection resources to. There was a recommendation that the PCAOB review firm training materials on professional skepticism. Here, too, I guess I regard this as something that's pretty deeply baked into our inspection process already. In the non-public part of our inspection reports, the quality control part of the inspection reports, I mean, certainly at least for the major firms, it's quite common for there to be comments of one sort or another about professional skepticism or perhaps instances where we feel that there was a lack of professional skepticism. That, in turn, triggers an obligation on the firm's part to remediate that quality control deficiency, which brings us into, I guess I would say, intimate contact with the training materials, the supervisory structure, the other aspects of the firm's program and compliance procedures that relate to professional skepticism. So we do look at those materials quite closely, although that's a part of our work that isn't really visible to the public because of the confidentiality provisions of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Seventh, there was a recommendation that we review and update the auditing standards governing fraud detection and reporting. There's been some discussion, I think, of that topic already at this meeting, certainly this morning, in that the risk assessment proposals that we have outstanding would integrate the consideration of fraud, the AU 316 obligations, more clearly into the entire process of assessing risk, planning, and conducting the audit, so that it doesn't seem to be kind of a separate or a bolt-on requirement. In terms of actually changing the fraud standard itself or the auditor's responsibilities with respect to fraud, I think, at least for the time being, we've felt that the problems in this area don't lie with the standard, they lie with the implementation of the standard, although this is certainly the sort of thing that the board would consider going forward and one of the kinds of things that I would think that the Fraud Center might be making recommendations or giving the board advice and guidance on. We've done some other things or proposed to do some other things in the standard setting area that relate to fraud detection. Certainly the proposed or the to be proposed updated standards on related party transactions I would put under that heading. Marty's already mentioned our practice alerts, particularly the one that came out yesterday about significant unusual transactions, and practice alert 3, which spoke about risks coming out of the financial crisis. Both of those, I think, are closely related to fraud detection. So with those seven that recommendations, that brings me to my second category, which are recommendations that involve things that aren't fairly seen as continuations of our existing work, but still are, in my view at least, closely connected to our mission. The first one I would identify under this heading is to create a fraud center, create a center focused on the prevention and detection of fraud and assist in the development of best practices in fraud prevention and detection. Again, as I think has probably been mentioned at this meeting already, earlier this week, we posted a job description, a solicitation for a candidate for directors to head the Fraud Center. So we're moving along implementing that recommendation. I mean, as I see it, the Fraud Center would do things like collect information about financial reporting frauds that have occurred, or perhaps have tools to look more deeply into the way that they occurred, look at best practices with respect to detecting financial reporting fraud and preventing financial reporting fraud, provide a source of information for academics and, for that matter, the profession, or people who want to do research on fraud, and certainly make recommendations to the board, possibly to the SEC and to others also, about ways to change standards and requirements in order to prevent financial reporting fraud. It has, I suppose, taken us a little while to get to the step of soliciting or inviting someone to apply to be the director of the center. I would only say that we gave a fair amount of thought to how the center should be organized and structured, and reached out to a number of people, I think some of them in this room, for advice about what the fraud center should be like. One question was whether it should be housed in the PCOB, be part of the PCOB, or be some sort of a separate or semi-separate organization, possibly connected to a university. I think we ultimately concluded that, in part because of the restrictions on our ability to share inspection information with anybody that's separate from us, and in part because we'd like to see academics from many universities rather than from a single university participate in the Fraud Center, that it was best to make it a part of the PCOB. But certainly at this stage, it's the new director of the Fraud Center, once he or she is selected, will have an opportunity to have a large voice in saying exactly how the center should be structured, what its budget should be, how it should operate, and how it can contribute to the board's work. Bob Burns in the General Counsel's office has been kind of the point person on laying the groundwork for the Fraud Center. And Bob, I don't know if there's anything you'd like to add at this point to what I've said about the center.
I think you covered it pretty well. The only thing I would add is that when we first decided to look at this recommendation, we're going through the process, we know that there are a lot of people out there already who have different ways to look at financial fraud. There are a lot of different organizations around the country, a lot of different universities have things on their website, accounting firms, other folks. There's many different ways to analyze the issue. And so I think the PCOB decided to focus just on financial reporting and look at the reporting aspect of it. And with that, of course, goes accounting and disclosure, auditing, all those types of things. In certain ways, it might look at executive compensation issues, other things related to that, even some corporate governance issues or so on. So the issues that the Fraud Center will look at, I think, will be, although tailored to the financial reporting issues, will be rather broad. I think, as Dan said, we reached out to a lot of different people to talk about this thing before we decided which way to go with it. And everyone that we talked to seemed to agree that the Fraud Center ought to focus on looking at the issues with an ability to provide forward-looking advice to people. In other words, give people advice as to what may be coming down the road, what the trends are, where the next problems might be, as well as just providing historical information about what has happened in the past. So I think we would hope the center would get into some of that as well. Other than that, I think Dan covered it pretty well. I mean, if anybody has any questions later, I'd be happy to talk to them about it. The posting is on the website, and know anybody? You know, have them send in their resume. We'll be happy to look at it. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Again, I think speaking for myself, when I saw the final ACAP report, I think I felt that the Fraud Center was one of the things that had the greatest potential to really help us accomplish our mission. I'm glad we're moving ahead with it. The second recommendation I would put in this category, that is closely related to our mission, but perhaps something that we wouldn't have done but for the ACAP recommendation, is the idea of mandating that the engagement partner sign the audit report in his or her own name. I think this group is probably pretty familiar with the history of that. It was discussed with this group in October of 2008. The board issued a concept release on engagement partner signature last summer. We received comments back, which I think were, I guess you would say, sharply split about the desirability of the idea. And as Marty indicated earlier today, the chief auditor staff is looking at those comments and I think envisions making a recommendation to the board in the very near future about how we should proceed with respect to the idea. Marty, I know you've addressed it already. I don't know if there's anything you want to add in terms of engagement partner signature.
I think you're right. I did address it, and we are in the process of digesting comments as well as practices in other countries and assessing some of the other issues that were raised in the letters, including potential unintended consequences or additional liability issues, and working with our Office of General Counsel in that regard. There's also some what I'll call mechanical issues partner signs 1 year, retires, that year gets restated, but the financials get reissued, and the next partner doesn't really re-audit everything. He just re-audits the restatement adjustment, so who's really signing for that prior year then? So I think there's some what I'll just call mechanical issues that I don't think can – I think they can be overcome, but we have to address those as well. So we're going through a lot of things, and as you said, we expect to get a recommendation to the board in the near term.
Okay, thank you. The third recommendation I would put in this category is undertaking a standard-setting initiative to improve the auditor's reporting model and clarify the auditor's role in detecting fraud. I guess I won't say anything at all about that since this group has been discussing that for the last day, and including this morning. And I just sitting here and listening to the report about the what the various breakout groups concluded and then some of the reactions to that, I think it's clear that there are some things for us to give serious consideration to doing, including both what was described as the kind of the low-hanging fruit and then perhaps a broader project that would involve forums or other kinds of input about broader changes or some sort of an addendum to the auditor's report. The fourth recommendation I would put in this category is a recommendation that we participate in roundtables with the other auditing profession enforcement regulators. I think the thought in the report here was that various bodies that have authority to bring enforcement actions with respect to auditing, that would certainly include at least ourselves, the PCAOB, the state regulators, and the SEC, meet periodically to share information about audit risk and how it should be addressed, about emerging issues and other kinds of information that would be important to enforcement bodies. That hasn't occurred yet, and the board hasn't taken any action on that recommendation yet. I have asked our enforcement director, Claudius Modesti, to reach out to the SEC enforcement staff with a view to discussing with them convening such a meeting. I would hope that it could occur before the end of this year. Perhaps if we can get together all the enforcement bodies that have an interest in auditing, we can work out with them whether it makes sense to do this on a periodic basis and exactly what kind of topics and issues might be addressed. So, again, this is in the very early stages. I think it's simply in the talking stage between us and the SEC, but it's something that, again, that we may have more to report on next time we report on these recommendations. That brings me then to the last category of recommendations, four recommendations that, to me at least, raise broader issues about the board's relationship with the auditing profession. And these are things that at least don't as directly relate to our ongoing work and mission. The first, and perhaps in that sense the easiest, is a recommendation that the PCAOB determine the feasibility of developing key indicators of audit quality and requiring firms to disclose those audit quality indicators. This topic was also discussed with the SAG at the October 2008 meeting. We had a series of breakout sessions on that and a report from someone in the UK about their reporting on audit quality indicators. Personally, I think one thing that I took away from that discussion was that this was not a simple topic, that defining audit quality was in itself a challenge, and coming up with indicators of audit quality, at least objective indicators, that would be meaningful and wouldn't encourage people to conduct their practices in a way that gave them a better score on the indicators rather than necessarily a better audit quality in their work, was not something that was simple. The IAASB currently has undertaken a project on audit quality indicators. I think IOSCO, I believe, is also doing some work in this area. And at this point, I think we're quite interested in the IAASB's project and understanding what comes out of that. And then I think we'll use that as a basis to decide where we should go next on the subject of audit quality indicators. There was another group of recommendations relating to the catastrophic risk at auditing firms. There was a recommendation that the PCAOB monitor meaningful sources of catastrophic risk that impact audit quality. I guess I would say that we, well, first of all, I would say I think this is an extremely important subject and certainly one that I take very seriously. If there were to be a failure, the loss of another large accounting firm, as in the case of Arthur Andersen, it would certainly have important ramifications for our work and for the public company community and public company financial reporting generally. This is something that's certainly important to us, certainly important to me. Our inspection program does collect some information related to catastrophic risk from the firms and learns about things like pending litigation against the firms, regulatory action that could impact a firm's audit practice, losses or changes in public company audit client population for a firm, staff turnover, and similar things. I believe that the inspection staff also gathers some more general information about exactly how the firms manage litigation. For us to go beyond that, at least in my view, would require us to ourselves become knowledgeable about, become capable of evaluating the way that the firms look at each piece of litigation pending against them, how they put, if you will, a value on that litigation and their strategy in handling these cases. Of course, the large firms all have numerous cases pending against them, some coming out of their public company practice, some out of other aspects of their work. I think that's something for us to consider, although a difficult area to get involved in. Of course, viewing it from a different perspective, you could view really almost everything we do as aimed at helping the firms protect themselves against catastrophic risk, at least catastrophic risk coming out of their public company audit practice, and certainly to the extent that the quality of auditing can be improved, the risk of liability coming out of auditing ought to decline. But I think at least currently we do get information on this subject as part of our inspection process. There isn't anything further we're currently doing with respect to that recommendation. There is a corollary recommendation, I would describe it as a corollary, that the large firms should be encouraged to adopt changes to their bylaws or their other organic documents so that they have a mechanism in place to deal with a possible catastrophe, a situation that could bring the firm down. To my knowledge, the large firms have not made such changes in their bylaws, and I can't say that this is something that we or the SEC, at least so far, have been active in encouraging them to do. The last two recommendations, I guess I'll kind of group together. One is that we explore enabling with the SEC the possibility and feasibility of firms appointing independent board members, independent members to their boards and advisory boards, and then that we require the larger firms to produce a public annual report and to file on a confidential basis with the PCAOB audited financial statements. Again, with respect to these two recommendations, we have not, at least yet, not to date, taken any particular action. I do know that at least, I believe, two of the large U.S. firms have begun issuing public reports in the United States, somewhat comparable to those that they issue in the EU. I guess I would only say that I think these are also important topics, and they're certainly ones that we've talked about and will continue to consider. To some extent, we've approached the ACAP recommendations by prioritizing them as those that relate most closely to our existing work, as I've indicated. I would also say that in terms of recommendations like this that raise broader issues, when I became acting chair a little more than 6 months ago now, I thought that we were on the verge of having three new members appointed to the board, a new board majority, if you will, and that these were the sorts of subjects that would be important for that new group to discuss as soon as they were in place. I still feel that way, but more time has passed than I anticipated before our three new colleagues appeared. But these topics certainly still remain on the list of things that we're going to be discussing early on with new board members. So I guess that completes my report. I think I've covered everything that the ACAP recommended to us. And again, I think many of the things we've made substantial progress on, and in many cases because they were things we were also working on. I would certainly admit that some of the broader, more far-reaching recommendations we haven't yet acted on, but we certainly haven't forgotten about them. And I would envision updating this group or in the future about the progress that we make. That's been a long monologue, certainly a longer monologue than I intended, but I'd certainly be happy to entertain any questions or comments from members of the SAG.